City. That's Houston, Texas-born Helen Sung and the Helen Sung Trio with Sea Jam Blues, composed by Duke Ellington in 1942, and it's considered a jazz standard. Helen is on piano, Peter Washington on bass, Louis Nash on drums. Helen is a graduate of the Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz, and she now lives in New York City. It's from her 2009 album, Reconception. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. It is Monday, March the 2nd, our first program after a short spell there. We had a couple of glitches, but they are being addressed. We had a situation develop where we had the PRN's studios had to move into temporary quarters because of a burst pipe that caused quite a bit of damage. And after moving to temporary offices, the agitator continued. Gary Null did a five-hour special program on the safety and efficacy of vaccines last week. You just heard it again, the subject. And PRN's computer system was hacked and its entire site destroyed. Naturally, this affected our programming. But apart from the benefit of hearing a couple of editions of Lead Stories once again, there's good news to report. It was not possible to do live programming, so you heard a couple of repeats of Lead Stories. But the technological and technical innards of PRN are well on the way to being fully restored and operational, and a couple more things have to be done before we are in fine form. So PRN, the good news is moving to larger, better, permanent space, according to Gary. That's what he said to me. A couple of programs, therefore, had been sacrificed to the gods. We'll make up for them. But in the meantime, thanks so much for your concern, your support, and your understanding, and of course your patience as we find our way to good and perfect order. So here we are on the eve of the big speech, and I want to talk about that today. I'll talk about, in the second half, I'll talk about a sign, a wonderful and welcome sign of hope coming out of Chicago. But first, let's talk about the big speech. Attempting to lessen the presumed impact of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's barnstorming speech before Congress, the White House has published a brief touting five things you need to know about the U.S.-Israel relationship under President Obama. In summary, it's billions and billions and billions of dollars in aid, strong defense of an ally, diplomatic help with Israel's neighbors, high-volume trade with Israel, and millions of dollars to help Israel with its refugee problem. Well, the protocol-breaking House Majority Leader John Boehner and his crass invitee Netanyahu, nonetheless, are banking on the speech because so much rests on it. For one thing, and the primary aim here is to derail current negotiations piloted by the United States with Iran on its nuclear program. But the speech also is supposed to help Netanyahu and his right-wing Likud party get reelected on March the 17th. And he is not a surefire winner in that election. There are problems people have with him in Israel, and it's dicey. So the speech would help him in that regard because he gets to be on an international forum, barnstorming his way, as I said, into the United States Congress at the supposed invitation of John Boehner, as if even if he was invited and it was clear that it was against protocol, Boehner did not discuss this with the White House, and it was just generally a very poor form for Boehner to extend an invitation, even though he says, well, Congress has the right to do what it can. It can issue invitations to heads of state, and so we issued one to Netanyahu, so live with it. But it's poor form. Let's just say it that way. So the speech could help Netanyahu bolster his chances for re-election on March 17th. It could help Boehner consolidate what seems to be his fraying power among fellow Republicans. And at the same time, it could help deprive, which is also part of the program, to deprive President Obama of much to boast about in his remaining 2 years. They will be torpedoing related policies. So, we are told, though, that the main focus here is the threat of Iran and its nuclear program. Let's look around and see what people are saying. I like to read a lot, so I found some pretty interesting pieces. And this one I want to share with you. It comes from Aaron Merat, writing for the Global Post. It's headlined, "The Israeli government has exaggerated the Iranian threat for years." I want to read this to you. Excerpts of it. He says, "When Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stood on the podium of the UN General Assembly in 2012, a picture of a cartoon bomb in hand, and claimed that Iran was a year away from being able to build a bomb, he did so in the knowledge that his country's own spy agency disagreed with him. A classified Mossad report leaked to Al Jazeera and The Guardian this week." Now, he's writing this on February the 28th. He says, "A classified Mossad report leaked to Al Jazeera and The Guardian this week revealed that its own assessment was very different from the prime minister's. At the time, Netanyahu told the UN, quote, by next spring, at most by next summer, at current enrichment rates, they will have finished the medium enrichment and moved on to the final stage. From there, it's only a few months, possibly a few weeks, before they get enough enriched uranium for the first bomb," unquote. The Mossad report, allegedly a correspondence with South Africa's intelligence service dated just 1 month earlier, in October 2012, said Iran was, quote, not performing the activity necessary to produce weapons, unquote. It went further, quote, "Even though Iran has accumulated enough 5% enriched uranium for several bombs, and has enriched some of it to 20%, it does not appear to be ready to enrich it to higher levels," unquote. This is not the first time Israel or Netanyahu has hyped the Iranian nuclear threat. It was in 1992, when he was an MP, that Netanyahu first prophesied an imminent Iranian bomb, claiming that it was 3 to 5 years from being able to produce a nuclear weapon. He wasn't the only one. That same year, Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres warned that Iran would have nuclear warheads by 1999. Later in 2012, Netanyahu claimed again that Iran was, quote, very close. They are 6 months away from being about 90% of having the enriched uranium for an atom bomb, unquote. A cursory look at news reports going back to the 1990s shows Israel has predicted Iran would produce a bomb by 1998, 1999, 2000, 2004, 2005, 2010, 2011, 2013, 2014, and 2015. Israel's motivations in containing Iran have varied over the years. The ideological differences between the two countries are well known, and Israel has always insisted that Iran represents a mortal threat to its existence. Today, Netanyahu has a more narrow goal in mind. The Obama administration and significant sections of the Iranian elite desire a normalization of relations between the U.S. and Iran, and a deal that is sellable to both sides, spoilers, appears within reach, not least due to a confluence of interests over the threat of Sunni radicalism in the post-Arab Spring political vacuum in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. But it is precisely this common interest that worries Israel, which has enjoyed unbridled American support for decades. It is likely that Netanyahu sees any U.S. detente with Iran as a zero-sum game in a security configuration that will see the current balance of power in his favor eroded. Now the stakes are just as high. Netanyahu is to make a speech, and he's saying here, the reporter, that it is designed to scupper a deal between world powers led by the U.S. and Iran over its nuclear program. So the predictions of Iran having this, as Netanyahu likes to call it, an existential threat to Israel, and this refrain has been heard many, many times, and it has been debunked many, many times by international authorities monitoring nuclear development in Iran and around the world. Let's look at what this 5 points that we ought to keep in mind, according to President Obama. What are the 5 points? One, he says, a strong defender. Israel remains the leading recipient of U.S. foreign military financing, receiving over $20.5 billion since 2009. In fiscal year 2016, which marks the eighth year of a 10-year, $30 billion memorandum of understanding between the United States and Israel, we have asked Congress for $3.1 billion in funds for Israel. The president has provided $2.9 billion in funding for missile defense programs and systems. Since 2011, the United States has provided Israel with over $1.3 billion from the Iron Dome system alone, including $225 million in short fuse funding last year. The U.S. and Israel regularly conduct joint exercises to improve our military capabilities and strengthen our bilateral security. Now, I'm reading directly from the briefing issued by the White House. The second thing to keep in mind, President Obama says, is that last year the U.S. opposed 18 resolutions of the U.N. General Assembly that were biased against Israel. So the U.S. is a strong international ally of Israel. The third thing to keep in mind is that the United States has repeatedly stood up for a two-state solution that ensures the peace and security of Israelis and Palestinians. under the president's direction and Secretary of State John Kerry, they initiated an intensive collaborative effort to facilitate negotiations for a comprehensive peace agreement between Israelis and Palestinians. And people should keep that in mind. Point four, says President Obama, is that the United States has seen to it that Israel's economy prospers as an economic partner. This year marks the 30th anniversary of the United States-Israel Free Trade Agreement, which was the first FTA entered into by the United States. U.S. goods exports to Israel in 2014 were $15.1 billion, up 9.6% from 2013, and up 64% from 2004. U.S. exports to Israel are up 587% from 1984. U.S. goods imports from Israel were $23.1 billion in 2014, a 1.1% increase from 2013, and up 58% from 2004. U.S. imports from Israel are up 1,203% from 1984. The U.S. continues to invest in this partnership, the White House says. Since its founding in 1977, the Bird Foundation, a U.S.-Israeli partnership between private sectors to expand private high-tech industries, has received $295 million in grants that have been awarded to 800 partnerships, generating over $10 billion in product sales. And finally, the fifth point to keep in mind, according to the president, is that in the last 6 years, U.S. humanitarian assistance to refugees and migrants traveling to Israel totaled $140 million. Since Israel's founding, the U.S. has provided Israel with more than $120 billion in bilateral assistance. And under President Obama's leadership, the U.S. will continue to be Israel's strongest ally and staunchest supporter in its pursuit of peace and security in the Middle East. Well, basically, it's money. Lots and lots and lots of free money that doesn't have to be repaid. And defense support and strategic support and boosting the economy and so forth. Of course, one would ask, well, gee, how about the U.S. for a change? How about some of that money coming to the United States? But I digress. We're talking about this issue of the nuclear threat, the existential nuclear threat that Benjamin Netanyahu will barge into Congress today and tell people, because he's the only one qualified to lecture the United States and particularly its president, its African-American president, who apparently, according to Netanyahu, doesn't know enough. He doesn't have a handle on this thing. So he's here to give instruction and at the urging of the equally odious John Boehner. We will set aside the racial issue here for the moment because one just can't imagine that this attitude, this would be done with any other president. It's just unprecedented, and it is outrageous. And, you know, you just can't help but understand that a part of all of this here is the racial implication. But here is what is phenomenally, mind-boggling. Here is a situation where everybody is agreeing not to say a very important element here that concerns Benjamin Netanyahu. And they all know it. They all know it. And it concerns nuclear weapons. Benjamin Netanyahu believes that he has the right to come before Congress because he and he alone can perfectly articulate the threat of Iran and its illegal nuclear program. John Boehner agrees. Many Republicans agree. And there's this whole crafting of the illegality, the crazy kind of policy making that Iran is indulging in secretly making these nuclear weapons, although internationally, the international monitoring agencies have found no reason to believe that that is happening. It's the same thing that was said with Saddam Hussein and so forth. But here is the thing. It isn't Benjamin Netanyahu himself who should be under investigation with respect to nuclear weapons. I'm going to read you a piece by Jason Ditz, writing for antiwar.com. And he files this piece on, let's see, January the 31st this year. In 2012, he says, the FBI declassified and released files of its investigation into how 800 nuclear weapons triggers were illegally smuggled from the United States to Israel. According to the FBI, the Israeli Ministry of Defense ordered nuclear triggers called Krytrons, encrypted radios, ballistic missile propellants, and other export-prohibited items through a network of front companies. Smuggling ring operations leader Richard Kelly Smith alleged that Benjamin Netanyahu worked at one of the fronts called Heli Trading, owned by confessed spy and Hollywood producer Arnon Milchan, and met with him frequently to execute smuggling operations. Israel officially designated the smuggling operation Project Pinto. Smith was captured, prosecuted, and incarcerated in 2002 after years on the run as an international fugitive. The Krytrons were believed to be destined for Israel's clandestine nuclear weapons program. When questioned by Israeli and Russian media about the smuggling affair, the Israeli Foreign Ministry denied involvement. Netanyahu, of course, is going to be I'm reading the report now. Netanyahu has recently announced plans to break diplomatic protocol and address the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, and Congress in March 2015, without coordinating his state visit with the White House. Now, that is pretty interesting stuff. So I looked further, and the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy, called IRMEP or IRMEP, discusses the situation about this clandestine nuclear program, and it is widely believed that Israel does have one. So is it odd that the person who was supposed to be intimately involved in smuggling nuclear triggers to help develop Israel's clandestine nuclear program is the person showing up today, pure as a driven snow, with the authority befitting a world leader who is above suspicion. And he's talking about what this country ought to do to bring Iran within the confines of the law and to basically scuttle its nuclear program, which international agencies have confirmed does not exist. Not the way he says that it's close to a bomb, and he said this how many times I just read to you. And it's as if nobody has any memory of this. None of the papers, none of the television stations, none of the advocacy agencies, except those who have been fighting this for a long, long time, trying to get transparency. The government knows it. The U.S. government knows it. Benjamin Netanyahu knows it. But this is the insanity that we are faced with. You see, this is how it works. This person coming to lecture the president and to lecture the world community via this speech before Congress actually should be prosecuted. Actually should be a target of prosecution. He should not be allowed in the country, according to the law. According to the law, he is to be wanted for questioning with regard to smuggling nuclear parts for nuclear weapons, and he is responsible, it seems to me, to answer the question about Israel's clandestine nuclear program. But have you seen a discussion about that? Or they're all talking about, well, it's a breach of protocol. The real issue here is that there is a person coming before Congress that everybody conveniently has decided is above question, is above suspicion. And by law, this person should have been arrested, should not have been allowed to even come into the country. By law, Benjamin Netanyahu, it seems to be, is a wanted man. But you see, when you have a compliant press, a compliant media, they can shift the focus so easily and let you believe that the unimportant things are important and the important things are unimportant. And the blatant hypocrisies like this can easily be set aside and we'd get to deal with trivia. There is a huge debate. I mean, in Israel, Israel is just bristling with debate about this. I will read you a story filed by Anshel Pfeffer in Haaretz just yesterday. If 2 months ago anyone had predicted that 2 weeks before Israel's elections, Benjamin Netanyahu would be addressing Congress against the express wishes of the Obama administration, no one would have believed that even Netanyahu would go that far. If the prediction had suggested that a week before the speech, a Likud campaign ad was accusing the U.S. of trying to prevent Israel's establishment and Netanyahu was blaming the world powers for allowing Iran to build a nuclear weapon, we would be calling for the men in the white coats. All that has now happened, and we are still no closer to understanding exactly why the prime minister, who supposedly knows America better than any of his predecessors, is plunging the strategic alliance into its worst crisis at a time when Israel needs support more than ever. Three possible reasons have been advanced. First, Netanyahu says that the U.S. Congress is the best place to warn the world against a dangerous nuclear deal with Iran. It's implausible that one speech, wherever delivered, can have that kind of effect, but Netanyahu has faith in his own rhetoric. Second, this is the Likud This is the Likud's ultimate strategy to dominate the election agenda and focus this campaign on one issue, Netanyahu's ability to handle Iran. Whatever the public thinks of him, the polls agree that a majority of Israelis still say he's better suited for this than any of his rivals. And while many find such reasoning the height of cynicism, Netanyahu and his immediate circle of admirers are convinced that Israel is headed for disaster if anyone else sits in the prime minister's office. It's not political expediency, it's national necessity. The third reason is rooted in the bizarre machinations and ego drives of Netanyahu's American supporters and patrons, chief among them casino mogul Sheldon Adelson. For them, a bruising quarrel with Barack Obama is not an unfortunate byproduct of the speech. It is the desired outcome. Each of these reasons figures substantially in Netanyahu's motivation to jeopardize the special relationship between Jerusalem and Washington. But the mountains of analysis and punditry so far blamed mainly Netanyahu and partly the speaker, Boehner and Ambassador Dilma Access. The unasked question is, would Netanyahu have even considered such a ploy if someone else had been in the White House? Netanyahu would never have dared to pull such a stunt on Bill or Hillary Clinton or on one of the Bushes because their retribution would have been swift and terrible. They would have stopped at nothing to destroy him politically, and not in Washington, but where it truly matters to Netanyahu, in Israel. The administration's response so far proves the point. John Kerry and Susan Rice this week have both criticized Netanyahu quite harshly, but telling Charlie Rose that Netanyahu's actions are, quote, destructive, and reminding a congressional committee of how he encouraged the U.S. to embark on the Iraq War may damage Netanyahu in America, but it's strictly for domestic consumption. None of this resonates among Netanyahu's potential voters in Israel, save for those Israelis who would never vote Likud anyway. If he had dissed a Clinton or a Bush in a similar way, the rule book would have gone out the window. A cohort of campaign advisors would have worked day and night, and a slew of truly damaging information would suddenly have been finding its way into the Israeli media, all to ensure his downfall on March 17th. But Obama does not play hardball. 6 years ago, early in Obama's first term, Netanyahu was still concerned about what Obama could do to him. That's why he made the Bar-Ilan speech, for the first time accepting a two-state solution and agreeing to freeze settlement building for 10 months. Since then, nothing has happened to make Netanyahu feel he needs to fear Obama. If at any juncture in that time the administration had made a brave and principled foreign policy stand, Netanyahu may have had second thoughts. But why should he fear a president who allowed Bashar al-Assad to blatantly cross every red line he drew in Syria's blood-soaked soil? A president who had no problem with one of his advisors coining the phrase leading from behind? A president who has absented himself from any serious engagement with Russia's creeping conquest of Ukraine, leaving that to the leaders of Germany and France. Obama has choked every step of the way in the chaos engulfing Libya, Iraq, and Egypt, failing to either exert U.S. influence over American allies or to stand by them. Pro-Western nations in the Far East despair over his lack of meaningful reaction to North Korean nuclear tests and Chinese aggression. Netanyahu never liked Obama. He feared him from the moment he won the 2009 elections, just 2 months after his inauguration. But which world leader who looked forward to the Obama era with hope has not been let down? Who has suffered from taking him on? He goes on. Netanyahu is wrong. Israel relies on its alliance with the U.S. in ways that few other countries do, and the damage he's currently causing will outlive Obama's last term. But for now, Netanyahu's living in the short term. It's not just Obama's singular inability to fight dirty that has enabled Netanyahu to take advantage. While the great majority of Israel's political and diplomatic establishment is up in arms at his recklessness, has no well of sympathy or respect to draw on to build an effective political counterattack. As in so many countries, Obama has succeeded in dramatically letting down both sides of Israel's political divide. Very interesting idea here that President Obama prefers to retreat rather than fight. Well, the most important thing that I wanted to drive home here is the irony, and it is well known. I mean, the media knows it. The media, they've covered this question. Certainly, people have raised questions about Israel's clandestine nuclear program that is breaking international law. And certainly, there had been an issue about Benjamin Netanyahu supposedly fronting a method of smuggling nuclear weapons from the United States into Israel and should be made accountable for that. But there he is, pure as the driven snow. And tonight we will hear the reports about this speech, and it will be the talk of the world by the same compliant press. I'll take a break now and talk about hope in Chicago right after this. Listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. All political eyes are on Chicago, where the incumbent mayor, Rahm Emanuel, unexpectedly finds himself in a dead heat with dark horse candidate Jesus Chuy Garcia, who last Tuesday shut Emanuel out of an easy re-election bid, he thought, and forced him instead into a runoff on April 7th. It will be the first mayoral runoff in Chicago's history. Outspent 12-1, Garcia, a Cook County commissioner, found victory in grassroots coalition support and intense voter dislike, both for Emanuel's policies and his personality. It was a stunning showing last week, and I want to talk about that for many reasons. I think, well, of course, he came from behind. It came out of nowhere, essentially. The field was crowded, and it was supposed to be a shoe-in for Rahm Emanuel, and he had tons of money funding his campaign. He was cocky, still is, just absolutely crass, another crass individual. But somehow, something began to happen, and largely, people are seeing that it came out of a grassroots movement that was formed around Chuy Garcia. You may recall that we talked with Karen Lewis, the head of the Chicago Teachers Union, some time ago, And she was actually being encouraged at that time to run because she had stood up to Rahm Emanuel and declared, helped to declare a strike by teachers in Chicago because of Emanuel's horrible anti-education policies. She developed a medical issue. She had a brain tumor, has a brain tumor, and decided that it was not going to be the best idea to run, although she would have done very, very well. She was enjoying a groundswell of support, but instead decided that she would support Chuy Garcia, as did other organizations and community groups, most notably the United Working Families, that's a grassroots movement, the Working Families Party, and a slew of grassroots community-based organizations. And they mobilized, and they knocked door to door, and they got a groundswell of support that stunned just about everyone. They didn't know where this guy got all these votes, to the point of forcing Emanuel, who went into the race very sure that he would get at least the 50% plus one to avoid a runoff, but in fact just pulled in 42.7% of the votes. Garcia, as the first-time mayoral candidate, a come-from-behind candidate, got 38.7% of the vote. Fantastic. This is great. I mean, you just have to jump up for joy. But of course, you know, there's work to do because come April 7th, it's real do or die time. So now this has been a serious wake-up call for Rahm Emanuel. What I'm suggesting here is, what motivated Chuy Garcia more than anything else, he said, his inspiration came from Harold Washington, a man I have talked about here many times with great praise and reverence. Harold Washington, the first African-American mayor of the city of Chicago, built coalitions. He invested. He did the work. He did the work and brought a whole bunch of people together, and they were in his corner. This is what Chuy Garcia applied and learned the value of community work, because that's what he has been doing for many, many years as an ally of Harold Washington. So it's a formula that works. The point I want to make is about Jesse Jackson. This is Jesse Jackson's hometown. And I'm speaking now to the importance of creating institutions that go beyond people's damaged egos. Jesse Jackson's run in 1984 and 1988. 1984, he ran as a true insurgent, talking about upsetting the status quo, including and perhaps especially of the Democratic Party. And he galvanized a range of people. In fact, it came to be known as the Rainbow Coalition, and people associate that with Jesse Jackson, but that actually was a concept floated by the Pan-African nationalist Fred Hampton, also from Chicago. He had talked about the need for a coalition to stand up to the prevailing order, the corrupt, the legendarily corrupt political order in Chicago. Jackson had, in 1984, a perfect opportunity to begin that process. And now in 2015, we should have seen multiplied all over the country the results of that model that could be replicated all over the country and create new leadership. But of course, he arrogated all of that energy, all of that investment to himself. And he's now Mr. Push Rainbow Coalition, the grand leader of the Push Rainbow Coalition, took it and just made it his personal property. The coattails were not very long at all. He didn't bring along anybody. So look at the gap. Chuy Garcia comes and he had to take the long route because, well, of course, Harold Washington died, but there was nothing there in Chicago that they could start with. They had to start from scratch. And this is why Chuy Garcia's forcing Rahm Emanuel to the wall here is so splendid. Because he has had, and the people around him have had to go back to square one. They have had to start from square one all over again. Because the people who should have put in place, as Harold Washington began to do, to put in place mechanisms that would outlast them and institutionalize a new way of doing things. Those people, like Jesse Jackson, scuttled, literally scuttled the potential of grassroots activism and scuttled the potential of change, genuine change through grassroots mobilization. This is in Chicago. And they let this goon, Rahm Emanuel, come to power. You notice you haven't seen an enthusiastic endorsement of Chuy Garcia by Jesse Jackson. You notice you haven't heard about that. So that here we have from 1984 to 2015, you have all of that currency basically gone. And that's why we need to understand this achievement here. Whether Chuy wins on April 7th, the fact is he has already won. And not just him. We're clear about that. It is a people's victory. And it was always possible. It was always possible. And that was the point of creating what turned out to be these political monsters like Jesse Jackson. You waste your time. You waste your energy. You waste your hopes in building somebody like that, thinking that they have a mind toward building institutions that would outlast them and that would advance the cause. Look how much Chicago has suffered because it took so long to recoup from the devastating loss of all of that currency from 1984 to 2015. But to their credit, they have done it. And Chuy Garcia, in my view, stands as a wonderful example that we can't give up the fight. And stands as an example of the possibilities of victory. If people decide that they have had it and it's time to for something else. But we cannot let people like Jackson off the hook. We can't let them off the hook. And we must always juxtapose the victory of a Chuy Garcia with the absolute betrayal of people like Jesse Jackson. All all across America, especially in the large cities. Look what happened in across the lake there in Detroit. And what's happening in Washington, D.C., and in Philadelphia, and in Baltimore, New York City, Boston. You pick a city, a major city, and you clearly can see the loss, the cumulative loss, when a political movement is hijacked, pirated, and arrogated for personal gain, rather than as the basis to launch new candidacies. There should be people running under the Rainbow Coalition umbrella for decades now. There should be a party, a Rainbow Coalition party in every city by now, if the intent was political empowerment, genuine political empowerment. It was not. I took a lot of heat back in 1984 and in 1988 when I called it. But look at where we are, and you see the result of the corruption of a genuine movement of people looking for something better and making the requisite investment, trying to move ahead. Right there in the city of Chicago, what did we get? We got a president, I just finished talking about him, got a president who gives black people all, gives them symbolism rather than substance. We can't say that there has been great progress. We have Jesse Jackson, who was singularly positioned, well positioned, to put into place that national mechanism that could have changed the political outcomes for all hurting people in America. But that was not his intention. Not his intention at all. His intention was, it's all about me. It still is. Right there in the city of Chicago. So I want to really just take this moment to say, in the midst of all this dismal stuff, we have to look at some of the gifts that we're getting. And we got a gift, the gift of encouragement, the gift of hope, the gift of possibility from Chuy Garcia. And I hope, I really do hope, that April 7th, Chicago is changed the same way that Harold Washington laid the groundwork for Chuy Garcia. Chuy Garcia would have laid the groundwork for somebody else to come right behind him. That's the beauty of the moment. So congratulations. And congratulations also, of course, to the people. The people who refuse to put up with this goon in City Hall. Closing just 50 schools this year, just this year, this past year, and has in mind to close as many as 200. We've been talking about this. A man with no real credentials for the job that he has had as Barack Obama's chief of staff. But he's of the Clinton variety. He's of the Clinton political persuasion. And it's all about money and power and corruption. So we pause. Every now and then you got to pause. This is a good day to pause and say, go Chuy. Go Chuy. I'm so thrilled about his performance. I'm so thrilled about the emergence in Chicago of a people's movement. It is so wonderful. I can't get over it. So I hope you share my joy, but I hope you also take it as a wake-up call of sorts about the possibilities of political change when we put our minds to it. Grassroots victory, absolutely celebrated. That brings us to the end of the program today. I hope it said something to you. Let me know at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Keep it right here on PRN.FM and spread the word about this great station. And, of course, as always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company once more. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.